I would like, in starting, to thank those who have helped me prepare this lecture and gather together the bits and pieces that have gone to make it up. There are quite a number, so I won't attempt to mention them by name. But, you know, the lecture has had, or preparing the lecture has had, one very sobering effect upon me personally. I have, until quite recently, thought of myself as one of the younger members of the society. It's not so long ago that I was in the Young Theosophists. But now I've been asked to talk about the personalities in the society that I have known and the personalities, some of them, which I have not known. The personalities who stand out over the 75 years of history of the New Zealand section. And in doing this, of course, I've had to go back, look backwards, and that's always a sign of getting old, isn't it? But I couldn't review the passage of time in the history of the New Zealand section without some comment on the changes that have taken place in the teaching and the expression or presentation of theosophy, and the influence that the various personalities about which I'm going to talk have had in those changes. And that's where my title has come from, the changeless, that in theosophy which does not change, and that which does change. And it's also given me a chance to express some of my own conclusions and opinions. And I offer these without any authority whatsoever. In my first Jayati lecture, I made some statements which Mrs. Lavender, who many of you will know, picked me up on. She said, "Where did you get your authority for that?" And I thought quickly and I hadn't got any. But still, I expressed the opinion. But the history that I'm going to give you is reasonably accurate. And you'll see many of the personalities face to face on slides which will shortly be shown. It may be a longish lecture, but I can cut some of it out. But I promise you, it's very varied and it won't be boring. But if you do get too tired or gets too hot or something, indicate to me and we'll stop. Now, that which is changeless was established by the secret doctrine in the three fundamental propositions about which you've already heard during this convention. And I'll just read them to you again in a condensed form, slightly amended. First of all, an omnipresent, eternal, boundless, and immutable principle. Note the word principle, on which all speculation is impossible since it transcends the power of human conception and can only be dwarfed by any human expression or similitude. It is the rootless root, beingness rather than being. Parabrahm, the one reality, is the first cause, the precursor of the life which can only manifest as a duality, as spirit, matter, as so on, about which we had a very fine lecture this morning. This is the concept of mahat, or cosmic ideation, and this is the basis of all intelligent operations in and of nature. Number two, the whole process of manifestation is governed by a law of periodicity, which of course was again talked about this morning, the ebb or flow, the night or day, and so on, which is the way in which life manifests in the physical world. The third fundamental principle is the identity of every unit of consciousness, which you can call jiva, if you like, or soul, and that one reality, they are one, and the obligatory pilgrimage of every unit or jiva or atma buddhi manas, the spark of the divine, the one reality, the obligatory pilgrimage of this through the cycle of incarnation in accordance with the laws of the law, the karmic law and the cyclic law. Now again, this is most interesting. No such unit, no purely spiritual buddhi or divine soul, she's talking now about the highest level, the atma buddhi manas, can have independent consciousness, and I take it this is when it has reached nirvana, can have independent conscious existence before the spark which has issued from the one reality has A, passed through every form of the phenomenal world B, has acquired self-knowledge first by natural impulse and then by self-induced and self-devised effort, checked by karma. And thus, ascending all degrees of intelligence from the lowest to the highest manas, from the mineral and plant to the holiest archangel. And these are the fundamental principles, that in theosophy which is changeless. We human beings are units of the one reality in a state of consciousness limited by the vehicles of expression. The cycle of necessity is the evolutionary process by which the unit learns to express its divine, and I put the word in italics because it's not a perfect word, its divine powers in increasing measure through the vehicles at its disposal. And that's the best way of looking at evolution. And this happens by efforts of growth. And this process depends on the increasing perfection of the vehicle through which the life expresses itself. Life and form are a duality. The one depends on the other. Now, our true nature is beyond the concept of normal thought, and the real purpose of life is beyond reason, so that we understand these fundamental principles in a very limited way. Madame Blavatsky said, the corner of the veil only has been lifted. It's like a man walking in a brightly lit room, the floor of which is opaque glass, and the observer, which is we mortal human beings, imprisoned in the world of flesh, are underneath this opaque glass, and we see the footsteps go across. And from the shadow that those footsteps make on the opaque glass, we build a concept of the worlds of reality at the level of Atma Buddhi Manas. We try to realize these fundamental realities in two ways. By speculation on the world of light that I described above the plate of glass, the world of reality beyond the mind, and some even get a fleeting glimpse, a fleeting knowledge of the reality of this world in meditation or in some other experience. The second way to understand this is to know more and more about the world about us, the nature of life at the personality level, and in the world of sensation and fixed things, the objective phenomenal world. And we must learn those in relation to the fundamental principles. In other words, by understanding the coming together of the two, we can expand our consciousness to an understanding of these fundamental principles. It is this understanding of the fundamental principles which changes. Its expression, and therefore our teaching of theosophy, changes, not only with the growth of our understanding, but also with the changes in world thought. Therefore, theosophy, as we understand it, and as we teach it, again in inverted commas if you like, as we express it, is changing. It has to be restructured, and the word is Mr. Perkins. It's a very fine way of putting it. It has to be restructured from time to time. And this, I think, is a good and a necessary process. Today we are more able than before. Today we are more than before aware of, one, the difficulty of expressing oneness, non-space, non-time reality with our finite mind. I think in the early days they were not so aware of the difficulties of this. And I think that we're now becoming aware that more than one thing can be true at a time. And physics, with some of its concepts, has led us to this understanding. In talking of those things which belong beyond the mind, we can't say this is this and that is that. They aren't like that. These realities have a quality of more things being true at the one time. And then we're understanding the difficulty of obtaining by paranormal or clairvoyant activity reliable knowledge because of the interference of our own finite minds and the interference of the thought world about us. So now I'm going to talk about the history of the society, and as I said, try and bring out some of these changes as I have seen them or as I understand them, and we will, I hope, at the end, be able to get something of a picture, not only of the people, but of what happened.
Now we can have the slides. Questions?
I played this because this hymn belongs to the era just before the turn of the century when Theosophy started in New Zealand, and this is one of the early photographs. Now, when you come to think about this, the words are quite fine. I know you could ask, who is God defending us from, if you want to? From the Asians? From ourselves? Possibly from the Australians. You will find if you analyze these words that they're quite in line. They're very beautiful. They're quite in line with the thought of the time. But they were very courageous people. They were very adventurous people. They were very strong people. But they had a sort of limited sight, as though they had blinkers on. And that's why they can ask God to defend them. Who against? The other nations. And what are the other nations going to do? Are they going to ask God to defend them against them? You see, that wasn't that understanding of the universality which we hope we have got to a little bit more now. Now, this is one of the very early groups. I don't know the date exactly. There isn't anybody there that we know very much, except that that is, of course, Dr. Sanders. Now, is Mr. Hardy here? Is Mr. Short in this group?
No.
We'll pass on because I haven't got the names of this group. It's probably about the 1900 and more carefully got in the later groups. So this one, not quite such a good photograph. These are very, very old photographs and we're lucky to get them as good as they are. This was a very interesting one because we know most of the people here. The first one in the center there is Mrs. Cooper Oakley. And she came to New Zealand in 1893, at the time in which the New Zealand section was linked with the Australian section in the Australasian section, as you probably know. Now, the people next. This is Mr. Sam Stewart, about whom we're going to say so very much. This, I've got these written down, and perhaps it will be safer to work from them. This is a Mr. J. Neville. This is Dr. Sanders, about whom we'll talk later. Mr. W. Wills. Mr. W. H. Draffen. Or Mrs. W. H. Draffen. We'll talk about them later. Mr. Sharland. I'm sorry, I can't do this. I haven't had enough practice. Mr. Dryland. And lastly, the last one is not known. This one in the front is not known. Those two are not known. And Mrs. Cooper Oakley. And then it is Mr. W. H. Draffen there. And Mr. McCulloch, not known. But the two that interest us most, the one that interests us most, this is Mrs. J. Neal here. But this one here is Miss Lillian Edgar, M.A. And she, I think, as I've gone through these, is the most outstanding of the personalities in the early history of the TS. She was one of the first MAs in New Zealand and I think in the British Empire. She, at a very early age, became interested in theosophy, and at quite an early age, she wrote this book, The Elements of Theosophy, which when I dipped into, I found that was very similar to Mrs. Besant's early works, and then actually she did base her work on Mrs. Besant's ideas. She went to lecture in about 1897 in Queensland. And in Queensland, she met Colonel Alcott, and they came back together to this country. I'm sorry, I'm a little ahead of myself. She was made the first general secretary of the section in 1896 when it was first started. Now, in between time, the Countess Watchmaster had been here, and others who had encouraged the formation of a section. And it was Colonel Alcott who came back with her and was so impressed by her lecturing that he invited her to go to India with him. So she was only General Secretary for 2 years, 1896-97. And this little book, The Indian Lectures, that Miss Lillian Edgar gave at Adyar and in India, in place of Mrs. Besant. And Colonel Alcott was so impressed by her that he took her over to India and asked her to give these lectures. Now, in India, she met a guru, and most of her life from then on was spent with him. But when she came back here in the 30s and later in the 40s, she did lecture for this society. And I don't know whether that's the next slide or not. No, it isn't. But she did lecture for the society, and I met her. I knew her when she was an elderly lady with a tremendous power of personality still. And actually, when I was teaching at the Santa School, she used to teach my two Latin pupils, the senior Latin pupils, their Latin. And I traveled over to Northland with her. Those of you will remember, a very keen mind. Now, Kate Browning was another New Zealander about this time who actually got an MA about the same time as Miss Edgar, and she wrote this book. Whether it was written in England, I'm not quite sure. She did go to England afterwards, but whether it was written in New Zealand or in England, does anybody know? It's published in London. I'm not sure when it was actually written. There is a picture of her later. No, I'm sorry. I knew this was coming. I couldn't show the other one following this because it's a composite one. Now, this is Dr. Saunders, whom I did not have the pleasure of meeting. To me, a very, very fine, beautiful face. And everyone has described him as one interested in the mystical side of things. And then as a propagandist. I don't know that the two go hand in hand. But there you are, Dr. Saunders, who was General Secretary of the Society from 1897 to 1918, and this is a long time. So we'll see him again in many of the pictures. Now this one is taken in the convention in Dunedin of 1899 to 1900. And we have the names of most of these, and if I can do it by memory, I'll make an effort. I think I know most of them. Some of them are not known. I think the first two at the top are not known. But I'd just like to point out the difficulties of getting to conventions in those days. People from Auckland had to go through Onehunga down by boat to New Plymouth, and then by train and more boat, or go to Littleton. I don't quite know, but I know in those days it was a tremendous trip. These two, I don't think, are known. This is Mr. Davidson, who helped Miss Lillian Edgar. And in her first report, which is published in one of our earlier magazines, she pays a very great compliment to him. This is Mr. Caber Harrison, and his wife is down. Am I right?
Yes.
Now, Mr. and Mrs. Caber Harrison were well known as actor and actresses, and of course, they lived a lot of the time in Hamilton. and they lived with Miss Bastin, as you know, and the studio where Miss Bastin knows, I understand, was their studio. They were very fine people and closely associated with Mrs. Esther Turner, who was for many years secretary of the HBB Lodge. Mr. Lodge is one of them, and this is a Mr. Brown. That one? Not quite sure. This is a Mr. Murray, who was one of the first members, a founding member, practically, of the Dunedin Lodge. And we have here Mrs. Draffin. Mrs. Draffin and Mr. Draffin were very early members of the Auckland Lodge, as it was then. Dr. Sanders, and this man is a Mr. Alexander, a great deal about. This is one we're going to talk about, Mr. Sam Stewart and Mr. D.W.M. Byrne. Now, this one down here is Miss Stone. Many of you will know her. She lived below Miss Crawford, and she was Assistant General Secretary for the section for many, many years. And this next one, of course, is Miss Christie. She wrote the book, Theosophy for Beginners. I haven't got a photograph of it, which was published by Adyar and is still sold. She was a magnificent lecturer. I'm told that she was very spectacular in her stories about the occult and one thing and another, but she filled the hall many night after night in Auckland and all over New Zealand. This is, I think, Miss Burton. This is a Miss Horn. Yes, Miss Burton. And this is Miss Horn again from Dunedin, and this is Miss Liddell, I think Mrs. Liddell. Now, I've got a better one of this, I think, because I want to bring up these two. Now, first of all, Mr. D.W.M. Byrne. He was the poet. And he wrote under the name of Marcius. He's had several books published, Eggs and Olives, Soundings, and there's another one, the name I've forgotten. And there's a very good article in him in the 1940 centenary Adyar Theosophist, which I'll talk about later. He saw New Zealand as a southern Norway, a land of mountain peaks. He was very keen on the idea that New Zealand was a southern Greece. But I was astonished to find in the poems published in that Adyar Theosophist this extract, which I'll read to you, because I can't help wondering what the young people would say today about these thoughts written in poetry by a very learned and a very fine man and a theosophist. He's talking about Messenes in the First World War. Proudly the tale of doughty deeds of these lads of hers New Zealand reads. In God's great book it is written down that never a nobler thing they did. I'm sorry, that never a nobler thing did they than fling their strong young lives away on the side of a hill by the Oozy Creek and the shell-torn dikes of Riverbeck. Here you are. Never a nobler thing they did. Our attitude, you see, to some of these things has changed tremendously. It's not easy to put the ancient wisdom into poetry, but he had a try at it, and I'll read you one little extract from that. For all depths must be plumbed, heights scaled, O soul that art truly me, ere we tread earth's stage in man's greatest role of incarnate deity. But never, oh never, the light shall fade of the large love we have won, till the Lord unmake all this he has made, and the day of Brahm be done. He was an eminent lecturer, and of course, a deep student of theosophy in those early days. I remember him at the first convention I went to in Dunedin, and he arrived on his bicycle with a little skull cap, an adorable, because he was old then, and a deplorable character. Now, we'll now talk about this man, Mr. Stan Stewart. The lodge in Auckland was under the control mostly of Mr. and Mrs. Draffen, whose son was the architect, incidentally, for the museum in Auckland. They were very fine, the Osprey. The son wasn't, and I know the grandson, and he hasn't been interested. But they were a little bit at loggerheads with Sam Stewart, who was very much an academic and a student. But the others were rather keen on spreading the ideas of theosophy. So in 1902 or 1903, there was a breakaway. An HPB lodge was formed, and the Auckland Lodge carried on under Sam Stewart. And now there is a marvelous story to be told. Because Mr. Crawford and Mr. Thompson actually reached Auckland from Wellington, where they couldn't stand the climate, with Gavin, and came to Auckland in about 1903, just after these lodges had split up. But it was a bit later that this incident that Mr. Banks has recorded took place, and I'll now ask that it be played.
It was either 1909 or 1910, just after I joined the society and I attended a convention at 351 Queen Street, Auckland.
The speaker.
And there, an episode occurred which made a deep impression upon me. There was a leader of the rival lodge called the Auckland Lodge, and his name was Sam Stewart. He's a very remarkable man with a great grasp of the secret doctrine. He was most fluent, and he was a man with a leonine head, and very bewhiskered, if I can say so, and he's very fond of boating in the harbour. He told me on one occasion, he said, "You know, Mr. Banks, I have a memory of being pirate in a former life, like a well-believer." Well, there was another very prominent leader, Mr. John Ross Thompson. He was the leader of the Breakaway Lodge, that broke away from the Auckland Lodge, because it was the propaganda lodge. The Auckland Lodge was an eclectic lodge, which believed only in study. They said that the outside world wasn't ready for this teaching. It should be carefully guarded and preserved. And this John Ross Thompson was an enthusiastic propagandist, the very great follower of Mrs. Besant and C.W. Levy. Now, at this convention, evidently there had been a plot concocted for some time beforehand by this Sam Stewart, when he accused Mr. Thompson, who was the General Secretary of the Society, of using the funds for his own purposes. And Mr. William Crawford, his great friend and colleague, was the treasurer of the section, and he was involved. So Mr. Thompson, you can imagine, was feeling hot with indignation, and he rose. When everybody was hushed, they knew that something would happen because of Thompson's reputation as a man of very decided views. And he polarized Sam Stewart in the most lurid, fiery language I've ever heard. Of course, they knew perfectly well that these accusations were groundless. And after a few moments, there was a tremendous and prolonged applause, which the delegates, of course, showed to be entirely sympathetic towards Mr. Thompson. And Mr. Sam Stewart retired abashed.
Thank you. while we're here, because I can't take this quite in sequence, I would like to say just a few words about Mr. Banks, Harry, as he's known to us. His interest has always been the Round Table and the young people. He's written thousands of letters to young people in New Zealand and all over the world, letters of encouragement and help on their birthdays. And wherever I went, and even in England and certainly in Australia, many people came up and said, "How is Mr. Banks? How is Harry Banks?" His influence on the young people has been tremendous. And it was through the Round Table, which has been his life work besides the church. It's been through the Round Table that he has been so well known. Now this, I've got to be a little bit personal in this. These came from some of Mr. Banks's albums, photograph albums. And this is the early Oamaru Round Table. And this person you will know was Bertha Sprock when she was younger. And the only one there that you might know is Mrs. Hosking, I think. Now, she did come to some lectures in Hamilton when she was living here. She came once when I lectured in Hamilton. I'm there. Took me a bit of time to find myself. A year or much longer. Now, this is only a very small town. A very small town, but the magnetic personality of Miss Sprott made it possible to have a very large round table. And always, of course, there was Mr. Banks who visited.
Which is you?
Now, I'll tell you how I first met Harry Banks. And he tells me he remembers, which is not too bad. I'd been with my brothers and some others having a fight with cow dung and clods of earth. And I came down into the dining room, the drawing room, and my mother was having tea, Mr. Harry Banks. And that was my first memory. Oh, I'll go back. Just some of you may know the ferries in Sydney. I think most of them there. That is a Dargy, she was. That's Kathy. And I think these are Judith and what's the other girl's name?
Amelia.
They're there also. I think that's one of them, and I think that's the other. This is the Round Table in Auckland, and when I didn't look at this carefully, but you will find up here, Mr. Crawford, Mrs. Crawford is there. It's not a very good spot, but if I can focus it. And Mr. Banks, I think, is there. It wasn't terribly good, satisfactory photograph, but this is the Round Table that Mr. Banks has built up and sustained. 1930 was the date of that. Now we're going back a bit. I don't know much about this group, but I was fascinated by the hat. But this is the first one. This is the first one in which John Ross Thompson shows. Mr. William Crawford. Yes, and of course Dr. Sanders, Miss Christie. I haven't got a list of this, it doesn't really exist. Unfortunately, we don't know who these younger people were, but I think that's Mrs. Hemus, who was a sister of Miss Lillian Edgar, and that would be Miss Stone again. Anybody who like to point one out, I'll put it. There's Mr. Banks there. Mr. Short?
Yes.
Whereabouts?
You see Mr. Thompson?
Yes.
The lady next is Mr. Short. To the right.
There. Oh, well, he was a Wellington, a prominent Wellington member. And a very, very fine worker. And I'm glad we found him because I didn't know him. And there's no record. These come from the section he spoke about, but there's no record, actually, of the names on this. That is, I think, is Mrs. Horn again.
It's Christie.
All right, yes, I've found Miss Christie. She's there.
Yeah, and Miss Browning on the other side of the...
Where's Miss Browning?
On the other side of the dock.
There?
That's it.
Oh, they say she's been masculine sort of
person.
Yeah, now this one, I have all the names. It's later, probably 1911. And at May Priest, it was in the Auckland Weekly. So there you got some publicity in those days.
Faces of anybody that you ever knew. She used to amuse children by the hour by pulling
faces. By pulling faces, did she?
She was an expert at it.
Yes. Now, this is Mr. Hemus, who was Jenna Hemus' father.
No, Mr. Young.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm starting wrong end. Mr. Hemus, Miss Horn from Dunedin, Mrs. Davidson, Mrs. Reed Wellington, Mr. McDonald, in the cargo, Mr. Banks, Mr. Sam Stewart, Mr. Williams. I don't know whether that's a father of Theo Williams. Would anybody know? No. Mr. Crawford, is it?
Yes.
Mr. Newton, who was evidently president of convention, John Ross Thompson, and Mr. Cooper of Christchurch, Mr. Charles Hemus, wait a moment, Mrs. Charles Hemus of Nelson, she must have been a proxy, she's there, and this will be Miss Christie, no, I'm sorry, Miss T. Andrew of Whanganui. And the next row, Miss Montgomery, who many of you remember, Christchurch and then Auckland's Assistant General Secretary for a long time. She was Secretary of Convention then. Mr. Christie, here. Mrs. R. Williams. Mr. Douglas of Hamilton. Miss Christie. Mr. D.W.M. Byrne, it looks like. Yes, Mr. Byrne. Mr. Smith of Napier, Miss Kathleen Hunt of Christchurch, who, of course, is Mrs. Crawford. Before she was married, this photograph was taken. I would just like to say, I think she's here tonight, so I have to be very careful, but I can remember her father and the wonderful home they had in Christchurch, and I'll talk more about Miss Hunt later on. But the wonderful work Mrs. Crawford has done, she has a magnificent ability of helping people, even at her age now. It's quite wonderful, the amount of work she does, helping them physically and helping them, if you use the word, spiritually with their advice. And she's a woman whose intuition and judgment is first class, and she's given her life for theosophy. Now, we got to this one. Oh. Mr. Gill of Gisborne. And this one here, Mr. Young and Mr. Prickett. Mr. Prickett, Miss Burton. Miss White, Wellington. Miss Hamilton, Harborough. This is Mrs. Miss Hamilton Howard, Mrs. A. Turner of Auckland, who some of you will remember, is there. Mr. Horn of Dunedin and Mr. Webb. I don't know if we'll get very quickly. Now, this is rather remarkable that this photograph has come out. It's from Mr. Banks' collection of photographs. And this is Ada, the old home where Bishop Thompson and Bishop Crawford lived for 15 years, where I was nurtured in theosophy, house of hallowed memories. Everybody in those days lived in Ponsonby. It was the centre that Epsom is now. The Hemuses had their house there, and the Draffens had a house which belonged originally to Miss Edgar, and they moved in, and it was their centre for lectures and talks. But Ada was the one where Miss Snook was having. Miss Snook looked after you?
Yes,
she was the housekeeper. Now there's a photograph of Miss Christie, is it? And Miss Snook at the back?
Yes.
And Miss Browning, the one who made faces. This is Mr. Thompson. This is a Mr. Reed, Secretary of the HPB Lodge, and this is Mr. Vickery, who some of you might remember. The one in the middle is nearly very faded, but it's still there. Mr. Hawthorne, P. Grattan, Mrs. Grattan, Bethel Hodgson Smith, Miss Burton, CWL, and the date of this is 1905. Miss Snook, JRT, and this is Fritz Kunz,
no.
A very young boy sitting in front, and Bishop Crawford in Portland. Now, CWL came twice, I think Mrs. Besant came twice, once before the century and once afterwards. I haven't got a photograph of her in Auckland. She filmed the hall up in Albert Street night after night. These are sketches from Mr. Banks's notebook. Awake, salute the Christmas morn. Mr. Thompson and the train going to a convention. Mr. Crawford snoozing. This is the well-known one that hangs in the lounge, which I photographed, don't tell anybody. Which is, of course, taken. What year would it be? 1908. It must have been a later. Yes. I won't go through all of these because this, Mr. Crawford, you will know quite a lot of them. Mrs. Hemus, Miss Hemus, Mr. Trevithick, Mr. Nichols, Miss Ockenden is here. Yes, well, I think we haven't phoned up for that long, but I haven't got a single photograph of her. She has worked, and don't you think that she didn't work for Theosophy. She was a great lecturer, and she was vice president of HPB Lodge. In her later years, she worked a lot for ceremonial movements, but she was a great worker for Theosophy in the early days. Mr. Martin of Sydney, CWL, Mr. Thompson,
Mrs. Heeman.
Oh, we've had Mrs. Hemus.
And Mrs. Keith, who did an arm around table with
where?
Mr. Crawford.
Where? Yes. Mrs. Peake?
Mrs. Peake.
Yes.
Janice Peake. No.
I can focus that a little better, but if I bring up that side, she comes up and these people go out and sit and pick. Mrs.
Trevithick's there.
Mrs. Trevithick, I pointed out before,
yes.
And I have a feeling Mr. Hanlon's there, but I'm not quite sure if that's him or not.
Mr. J. Fillion Sr. next to Mrs. Hemus.
Next to Mrs. Hemus.
Yes, that's
where
right.
Are we? Here?
Yes.
There?
Yes.
Is that right, Josh?
Yes, right.
And Helen Sahara's mother is there too.
Oh,
where?
She's behind behind Mr. Leadbeater and next to Miss Hemus. That's right.
That's
yes.
Mrs. Sahara.
Yes.
Yes.
There?
Oh, yes. This is Mr. J.H. Simpson. He was a retiring editor of TNNZ at this stage when this photograph was taken. He also was the one who inspired the formation of the Santa Garden School, in which, of course, Miss Bertha Dower made it, which Miss Bertha Dower made her life work and did a wonderful job, which I was associated certain times. It had to close 1959 because we couldn't get suitable teachers, we couldn't get money, and there was a flagging in the interest of the members. But he was a very fine man, a fine student, and a member of the Onehunga Lodge when that one existed. Oh, the Santa Garden School, as it used to be, but all the buildings have been demolished now. Now, this must be something different. John Ross Thompson, in his heyday, took the Study in Consciousness by Mrs. Besant as his study class book, week after week. And they were magnificent study classes. And I think that that book by Mrs. Besant is one of the best she wrote. For one thing, it's written as a book. It's consecutive. And it has in it fundamental theosophical ideas. Now, in that book, you find the idea of the permanent atoms. And this isn't in HPB's writings, as far as I can find out. The skundas are there, and the beads on the string. And just for a little bit of variation, to show how things have changed, I want to take you... Now, wait a moment. Perhaps I better not, just at the moment. I better say a few words about JRT. I've skipped over one page too many. Miss Ockenden, who you saw a while ago, said about him that he was very close to the heart of things. And many of those who knew him know that this is true. The influence that that man had on people's lives was very remarkable indeed. It was as though he brought the whole of their inner self out into the front, and they were aware of the reality of the existence of that inner self. And I'm going to quote from Mr. Mathis, who I think is here tonight. He wrote me a letter about this, and just a few words. Mr. Mathis of Wellington, who most of you will know, said he was so vital with boundless affection and patience with every young man like myself, and infinitely tolerant of our boring selfishness and egoism. And he sometimes had me in tears as he shook down my spiritual equilibrium to bedrock with Highland forthrightness. Now, if the earlier age that we had been talking about especially belonged to the Sam Stewart era, if that age was academic, and I think it was, there was a certain tendency to study for the sake of study. And it is marvelous, I think, that some got through to the real teaching of theosophy in the way that HPB intended it should be understood. But the time we're talking about with JRT was the golden age of theosophy, when there was added to that academic quality devotion and ethics. Now, whether you can add ethics to a society that has objects as broad as this society is debatable. You can add ethics that belong to brotherhood, admittedly. But I still maintain that this was a golden age of theosophy when the band of servers were active. And they had a quality of faith and confidence that was unique. And it was this quality of faith that led them to the close touch of the masters of the wisdom and the ethical teachings that I've talked about. I don't fully understand why and how this happens. But it does happen. A quality of simple faith is that which allows it seems to subdue the personality, and or perhaps it's one-pointedness, perhaps it's the bhakti, the devotional aspect, allows the higher self to come in tune. But there are some aspects of the Besant-Leadbeater era that are more difficult to carry forward into the future, and they have to be restructured. Some of their teachings were dogmatically presented, and when we're moving now into the Aquarian age, they are not acceptable in that form. Now, I mentioned the Study in Consciousness, which Mr. Thompson took as his weekly study class. And I've done, just to vary the lecture, time slipping by, but I think we have time to do this, a diagram, because I'm trying to illustrate the teaching of reincarnation as it was then and as it's now becoming. First of all, you have continuity. Atma, buddhi, manas. And if it, you call this the ego, you are, I think, in danger of making yourself into a subculture, as the young people call it, because the word ego in general understanding, in general literature, means a developed personality, a separative, strong personality. And if there's anything that the higher self is, it is not separative in that sense. We have to drop the word ego. And I'd like to see it myself cut out of all the quest books before they're published. I know this is difficult. This is Atma Buddhi Manas, Jiva, the transcendental self, if you like. The higher self, yes, but not so good because it's a distinction of up and down. That exists, and that is the reality. The Jivatma, if you like, of the one. Now to me, incarnation, the similarity to a girl in a bikini is incidental. Reincarnation is a coming down from the continuity into discontinuity. And we have always thought of it as going back, as it were, going up and coming down. But it's really a coming down into a world of limitation. Now, if you look here, you see that I've indicated the Atma Buddhi Manas, the Manas anyway, the consciousness coming down and playing through all the time into the lower world. If you take the yellow as the mental, and this as the astral, and this as the physical. Now again, we split them into planes. And this is something we're going to find difficult to outlive. Actually, of course, the physical, the astral, the mental, and the higher mind, and on to the buddhic and the atman, are like the notes on a piano. They're a continuity. Any division into planes is purely artificial. It's the one continuity going higher and higher, or varying in the vibratory rate, if you like, and that is matter. So life exists in this coming down and this consciousness. Now, the consciousness never incidentally goes beyond the physical brain. Perhaps it should have come down halfway into the physical. But this is going on all the time, and that is incarnation. Now, we've always been taught that at the end of an incarnation, as the life withdrew, the essential experience was brought up and absorbed and became part of the Atma Buddhi Manas, or the higher self. Is that right? Is that what you've understood? Yes. That's the way we've been taught. Now, we're being challenged a little bit now. We have heard it said that it is possible that for a quick return, appreciate the word, to actually have the same astro-mental body carried over from one incarnation to another. And I think this is probably the case. But since those days, there has been a lot of investigation done by hypnosis. And we can't ignore all that has been done. The latest book that has come out is by Joan Grant and her new husband, the third of four, Dr. Kelsey, who's a medical psychologist. And the rather waffling sort of feminine quality of Joan Grant's books has been, in some cases, in some chapters, replaced by the stability of a man's mind. using hypnosis, and he calls it a state of altered consciousness, He's used this as a medical tool. And he has been able to regress back under hypnosis. He has regressed patients back through a past into childhood, to birth, to prenatal conditions, and into previous lives. And you know from Joan Grant's books, you get the feeling that she actually does know something about the recall of previous lives. And they suggest, between them, quite strongly, that the superphysical, as they call it, does not die between incarnations. We each have a string of them and use one only for a particular life, but can contact the others and use them and remember through them. Now, this is a very interesting point. You see, if it's true that all our experience, each life, was taken back to this continuity, then any remembering of a past life would be through that continuity. But in these cases of hypnosis, there is an emotional engagement in the memory of the individual, which indicates that it's coming across at an astro-mental level, which does suggest that in quite a lot of cases, there is a memory of a past life at that level, across there, without going through the continuity. It's some of these things that we in the future have got to look into a little more deeply. I know you'll say there's the memory of nature and the Akashic records and so on, but I think we have to be very careful about this. The more I try and find out about this, the less I can. There is a quality of Akash. Dr. Besant says the Akash is that whose only quality is sound, and that's quite another thing. The Akashic record. There is a memory of nature, but I don't think we can explain the regression into a past life through hypnosis by using that. Now, this is possibly, by the way, but it's showing how we've got to be careful in our thinking from life on. Anyway, we had our own excursion into previous lives and the lives of Alcyone, and when I was preparing this lecture, I was reminded about a story that happened at Dunedin many years ago. A lecturer was lecturing about Alcyone's incarnations and the lives of Alcyone, and he said, well, this was a very unimportant life. Alcyone was born as a woman and she had 13 children, but it wasn't. Clara Codd, who came here in the 20s, and if you read her book, So Rich a Life, you'll see how muddled up she got about the HPB Lodge and the section headquarters. But she gives a vivid description of them. But I couldn't, reading all that book, find out what date it was. It's a rather muddled book. It's her autobiography. And it staggers me, it staggers me to find that that woman, in her much older years, has written such fine books as The Way of the Disciple, The Ageless Wisdom of Life, and I think it is Lend Yourself to Life. Trust Yourself. Marvelous books. And you think of the age she was when she did that. Now, this is the book by Dr. van der Leyen. And Dr. van der Leyen came to New Zealand in 1928. I remembered, I was a boy at school. I had been trained a little bit by Miss Gifford, headmistress of Whanganui. And she was an Oamaru in the round table. She used to take us with Uspensky's 30 more organum. And I learned a little bit about the fourth dimension then. In fact, I think I knew more about the fourth dimension then than I do now. It's a difficult subject. Anyway, I remember in that little hall, Dr. van der Leyen stood up. He must have just written The Conquest Illusion then. And a lot of old ladies, they were fairly elderly even in those days. He said, this isn't a table. This is just what you see in your mind. It's a lot of sensation building it itself into a table in your mind. That's all. And I wondered what they made of it. Now, he also wrote a book called Revelation or Realization, The Conflict of Theosophy, influenced by Krishnamurti. This book was in our book depot, but not sold.
Let's have a look. This was an indication of the breaking of the storm, those powers that start to restructure things. And I'll read you just a few extracts from this. Some of them I don't agree with, and some of them you won't agree with, but it's interesting to hear them. Theosophy must cease to be a philosophy of the beyond. The open door to the realization of spiritual reality lies in the here and now. The society must cease to be an exclusive brotherhood which can speak of the outside world. One of the meetings over there this afternoon, we spoke about the outside world, didn't we?
Yes.
The claims of theosophy to explain the problems of life has no appeal to the modern man who knows that life is not a problem to be solved, but to whom it is a search and an ever-increasing experience. Theosophy should be a realization of life by each man in his own consciousness and not a hierarchical system of revelation, where truth and enlightenment come to us through others and where the guidance of our life rests on orders received by superiors. Soon after this, he was piloting solo his own plane in South Africa and he crashed and was killed. Dr. van der Leyen. Oh, this is just a picture that I was made that came up. This was John Ross Thompson when he was older with walking. We went to see an air display in Epsom. This is Sirius Crawford, who was killed in the Air Force in the war. And this little boy is Jimmy Waugh, who was killed in the Fleet Air Arm in the war. These are the general secretaries, about which I will talk, but it's just really to capitulate. Miss Lillian Edgar, Mr. Thompson, we're taking an order, Mr. Lillian Edgar, Dr. Saunders, Mr. Thompson, Mr. William Crawford, and Miss Hunt. I'm not covering the ground after this. This is a program of about the late 30s in the HPB Lodge in Auckland. And I put this in originally because it had... it'll come back. You may not be able to read them, but that's Miss Lillian Edgar there. I kept it because my own name is down there. But this is the lecture I gave on the seven ways of development. Mr. Crawford afterwards told me I had the animals wrong. I had the wrong one, the wrong race. And probably I did, but... Looking back, I find it difficult to believe that we should be so dogmatic that there is one particular animal belongs to any particular ray. They typify a ray, but I don't know. And Mr. Sandstone from British Israel, and I often get asked, how many outside speakers should we bring in to onto our platform? Mr. Sanger, British Israel Association Musical Evening, Mr. Edwin Grace, Vice President of HPB, Mr. William Crawford, General Secretary lecturing, and Mr. Lyon, Captain Lyon, Hypocrisy of Democracy, obviously not a theosophist, Miss Ockenden. We did bring them in, you see. Mr. Geoffrey Trevithick, Mr. A.J. Mills, who went to Christchurch, this is a little play, and Miss Ockenden again, myself. But they were interspersed with lecturers who were not strictly theosophists. Look, Minnie Arundel, as she was when she came here in the early 30s, she came twice then with her husband. And I remember Dr. Arundel saying, change, change, move your furniture, change everything. He was upset that New Zealand lives in a bit of a rut. I suppose we are. They talk about the complacency of the New Zealanders. And it's a rather beautiful picture of her. And of course, at that time, she was doing her dancing.
20 years
old. Just over 20. This is a picture of a youth magazine brought out by the Young Theosophists in Auckland. It's a Maori decoration. It was done, I think, by one of the Edens, who are not here, and subscribed to all over New Zealand. And it was very good. Mr. Milton Thornton, who was president of HPB Lodge, and a very marvelous personality, and really a rather wonderful theosophist. Now, it's interesting to me to look back and see the number of men who died a premature death, who were about my age group. Theo Williams of Christchurch was killed in the war. There's
Milton, who died 15 years ago now, Freddie Hilder in Christchurch, who was a lecturer, was Teddy Dan, who was another lecturer, and Tom Naylor. There may even be others, but it's quite a number. Milton was loved by all, one of those people who were very friendly and helpful to everybody. And he was one of the editors of that torch that we saw before. And now I come to the second of the shake-ups, as it were. Krishnamurti, he talking at the Santa Garden School under the elm tree, weeping elm. Remember it very, very well. 1934, I think. Mr. Banks knows the name of the gentleman.
Mr. Moss.
Now, something happened in 1939 when he came again that I think I should just describe to you. The HPB Lodge had offered him the use of their platform in their building. And it was arranged that it would be for members only. Mr. Trevithick was in charge. Now, remember that there was an arrangement that there would be some sort of label or badge that you would be able to know the members. But Mr. Mackay from Sydney and the Tidswells and his group came in with Krishnamurti. A whole band of them walked right straight up the steps, pushed all the HPB Lodge officials aside, and went right up on the platform and sat there and continued through the whole of the meeting to bombard Krishnamurti with leading questions, which were ones that he could answer against the good of the TS. This to me made a biting, a deep impression. I don't for a moment think it was Krishnamurti's fault. But some of the things that happened in those days were very, very difficult. John Ross Thompson said that Krishnamurti was complementary to theosophy. I'm not quite sure that I agree with that. But I have come to the conclusion that what he is teaching is very nearly Raja Yoga. He is teaching us that that which we carry with us, a build-up of thought and feeling, is that which is holding us back. And that we should meet every situation without any of the past. We should meet every situation with love in our hearts as though we'd never met the situation before. Anyway, it upset. He was a great friend of John Ross Thompson's, and they went up and they talked together in his house. But I understand from Mr. Banks and others that it was a tremendous shock to Mr. Thompson that Krishnamurti repudiated Mrs. Besant and so many of the people that had tried to help him, and some think that it was one of the causes for his early death. Again, talking at the center, he said, there is no tolerance, and this I remember, there is no tolerance. If you love, if you truly love, you can't tolerate. I mean, it isn't part of the question. It doesn't come into it. You see, he's talking all the time, and still is, in a different way from the way in which we've been thinking. He has done so much to restructure the thought of all theosophists. He came again in 1946, and there's the program. A little bit older. He didn't come back when he was in Sydney. In 1940, Mr. Geoffrey Hodgson came to the convention in Christchurch for the first time. And of course, he has now almost made New Zealand his home, although he only comes here off and on. And he has been a tremendous inspiration for many, many members of this society in New Zealand. And our debt to him is tremendous. But I'm not going on to this period after the war, except that I would like to say a little bit about the 50th anniversary convention. Now, Miss Hunt, at that time, was the General Secretary, 1946. And Miss Hunt was a person of a tremendous interest, who had a tremendous interest in the welfare of New Zealand. She was a brilliant lecturer. She didn't use notes. She was not a student in the strict sense of the word, or didn't appeal to me as a student, but she had a tremendous wide variation in her interest and her ability to understand things.
Would she have been any relation to the
she at that time was General Secretary. And she was General Secretary when this book was produced. Now, I'm sorry this is such a poor photograph, but this is the Adyas Theosophist, the centennial issue, which is most interesting. When I first opened this up, I thought it was a sort of a guidebook to New Zealand. But when Mr. Perkins was talking, I began to realize that probably this was done intentionally. I know Miss Hunt had a lot to do with it. It also had a photograph of Michael Joseph Savage and an article by him. Miss Hunt once said to me that she would have liked to have worked for the first Labour government in New Zealand in any capacity whatsoever, because socialism, to her, was an ideal. And this book, you'll find quite a lot about New Zealand, a tremendous amount about New Zealand, a little bit about theosophical activities in New Zealand, but it's a very interesting book to see. Now, this is the Theosophy in New Zealand. That was 1940, by the way. That was the centenary of New Zealand. This is the 50th anniversary, the golden jubilee of the Theosophical, the New Zealand section of the Theosophical, the New Zealand section of the Theosophical Society. Notice that here there's the twin peaks of Mount Cook. Now there is Mount Cook, and it has got sort of twin peaks, but why it's of value as a, I never really understood. I thought a single peak would be far more impressive. Now you've got some scenery tonight as well, just a bonus. This is the convention held in 1946, and this is a very old photograph that I had rolled up in the drawer. It's crumpled and creased, but whether you think this was a bigger convention or not, I don't know. But it was a very big group that was photographed. Now, you will get most of Mr. Banks, Mr. Trevithick, N. Sri Ram. He wasn't president then. This was his first overseas trip. Miss Hunt, Mr. Hodson, Mr. Mathers, Miss Montgomery, Miss Bertha Dow is there. This person
Mrs. Cross.
Mrs. Wellington. Cross is it from Wellington. And many of you may pick yourselves elsewhere on that group. There's the tail end of it on the other side, Mr. Mason and Mr. Banks again, and so on. And there's the other side. Miss Bastian is here. And Mr. Griffiths, Miss Strock. I think that's Mr. Pope, Miss Bertha Dow. Mrs. Clayton, is it there? That was a very large group, and if anybody has got the patience to get the original photograph and count the number and compare it with the photograph that's taken tomorrow, I'll be interested to know. And you've got the Australians to help you tomorrow. Now this, I think, must be getting near the end. This is a magnificent diagram. I don't know where it came from. This Peter Vink in Wellington gave me this. He drew it, I think. I think it's used by I'm not quite sure where it actually comes from, but as a diagram, it's a marvelous diagram. If you take this as the physical, that as the astral, and this as the mental, and then this as the higher mental, using planes, which are worlds, and this as the vedic, and then you get the atmic, and then you get the center, which is the one. Now, the point is that there is a variation here where the lines cross. Inside this, we have unity. Outside it, we have separateness. This is the antikarana, where the consciousness of our stage of evolution, anyway, bridges the gap, jumps the gap from separativeness to an understanding of unity. And I'm suggesting that if you talk about brotherhood, it exists inside here. fundamentally, because that's where we are one. Brotherhood, if it does get manifested in the outside world, out here, well and good. But evolution is when the quality that exists inside here is manifested in the world of separation. And if you look at your problems that way, there was a problem came up a while ago about nature's red and tooth and claw, and why is it that animals kill one another and so on. Well, you see, outside here it is separativeness and that and competitiveness and so on. That is natural. The real is inside. Now, there's all sorts of ways you could look at this diagram to help, and I haven't time tonight to go on. Incidentally, the study of group souls and things is one that needs overhauling. It's one that's got to be brought up to date in line with modern findings. Philosophy in New Zealand, which is one of the finest magazines. And in that case, it's got N. Sri Ram as the president. And this is the very up-to-date issue. Hello. Is it stuck? I had the latest name, Mrs. Dunningham, I'm very sorry. Because I do think that this is the... Oh, we should try it. It's got the headquarters on it, the Belvedere Street headquarters. The latest right up to date. And it is a magnificent magazine. Somebody said one of the best in the world. And this is the headquarters in Belvedere Street, the headquarters of the New Zealand section. And this is the very latest one. This year. Now, I had some other slides, and I hope there would have been time to show them, about some of the clairvoyant things, and especially Atlantis. A lot of interesting things have happened in the study of Atlantis, but we won't have those tonight. I want to close in a slightly different way. The drifting, the continental drift is the thing that has sort of thrown this in the melting point, but we won't have time for this.
I don't know.
And I'm going to be extremely careful in what I say. Some of the ideas which the society put before the world, one of the ideas which the society put before the world was the idea of brotherhood without distinction of race, creed, caste, sex, or color. And as an idea, and I haven't said universal, and as an idea, this has been accepted throughout the world. It's commonplace today. And you find it in the most unexpected places. We look around for signs of something that is new and important, and this is the thing that we see most clearly. The youth today represent, I think, a change. And I quite clearly, in my own mind, think that there is a difference now between youth and the older generation that did not exist in our day, and it's a difference of quality that is quite remarkable. They seem to have a built-in knowledge of so many things that to us were important. They're not important to them because they know. You see, you will find that. I've got two sons that have educated me. They are not willing, and this was said today, they're not willing to perpetuate the rigid pattern of life that we have accepted, the establishment, as they call it. They have a strong sense of the right worth of the individual. And this has bad aspects, leads to violence. They are doing the things that we have talked about. And many of the young people today are not talking about social service. They are trying to get positions where they do social service.
And I think this is quite remarkable. And they're seeking human values based on love, the return of the gods of compassion, as it has been called. John Ross Thompson used to say that love is the only life that is real. And life without love is like water lost in the sands of the desert. And today, thousands of young people are turning to yoga and to meditation all over the world because Christian religion, based on the rigid Jewish principles, because they are, has failed to inspire them. And in many cases, the swamis, the new missionaries from the East to the West, are teaching Patanjali's Raja Yoga to their pupils. They know it. They teach Hatha Yoga first, but they will teach Raja Yoga later. And we in the TS must use more and more our Sanskrit terms, which we've been given to us. And I was most pleased to hear Mr. Perkins say that the other night. Because, you see, the Sanskrit terms are not the Christian ones that were used in so many of the books in the Leadbeater Besant era. The Sanskrit terms have a mantric value, and they also have no links with the civilization, the Christian civilization in which we live, and they are able to reveal to us depths of meaning, which I think is most important. They're not limiting, they have mantric value, and they carry us back to the days of the Vedas where the truths were heard and realized and not read about. So we should not stand by and see the outside world rapidly learning of karma, of viragya, and ahimsa. Pali, isn't it? Not Sanskrit? Am I right? Anyway, they are using those words. The use of the Sanskrit words is growing in our literature. And why should we abandon them? Who were the first to use them? And we have used them in the purest form of the ancient wisdom. The Beatles Maharishi, who has, as some of you may know, a little voice and a funny, nervous laugh, but he has succeeded in inspiring many, many people throughout the world and passing the teaching of the ancient wisdom to the world in a way that we have not been able to. When on television, he didn't talk about the God within, because nowadays the God is dead, there's all sorts of almost blasphemous things saying about God. Because if you go back to the first principles that I enunciated earlier, God is all that there is. How can it be dead? Anyway, the Maharishi talked about the depths of the mind. The depths of the mind in each one through which the oneness of life may be contacted. And so, in conclusion, I'm going to play one of the Beatles records, which is called Within You and Without You. And when you realize that this record is so well known to thousands, millions of young people throughout the world, if you listen to the words as I read them, you will see that there is something happening in the world, the young people today, that is very, very significant. We were talking about the space between us all and the people who hide themselves behind a wall of illusion. Never glimpse the truth, then it's far too late when they pass away. We were talking about the love we all could share when we find it, to try our best to hold it there. With our love. With our love, we could save the world if we only knew. And here's a significant line. Try to realize it's all within yourself. No one else can make you change. And to see you're really only very small and life flows on within you and without you. We were talking about the love that's gone so cold and the people who gain the world and lose their soul. They don't know, they can't see. Are you one of these? When you have seen beyond yourself, then you may find peace of mind is waiting there, and the time will come when you see we're all one, and life flows on within you and without you.